have just entered the Ascension Age, where you are now among all who have witnessed the unexplainable. And now, your guide to the Ascension Age.
Hello world, this is TJ Morris and you're listening to ET Radio. Welcome aboard, all you people. I've been online now for about a minute or two and the lines are open for you to call. Guest call in is 347-945-7207. We are the ACO Curious Conscious Club, and our tags are Ascension, Psychics, Paranormal, UFOs, and Spirituality. Normally we have Tony R. Elliott. I don't see him on the board tonight, but normally this is his night, Saturday nights, per his arrangement with me, so we'll see if he shows up. Our category tonight is Spirituality. We're visible to everyone around the world. Our duration is approximately 120 minutes. Our showtime tonight is January 25th, 2014 at 2000 hours, 8 p.m. Central, 9 Eastern, 7 Mountain, 6 Pacific, and 4 Hawaii time across the United States of America. And the other time zones, thank you, and we hope that you enjoy working with us around the world. We are a global community. We are the ACO LLC, funded and founded in Kentucky. Proud to share ACO Metaphysics with Tony R. Elliott, Director of Texas, USA, of ACO, and we are the Curious Conscious Club. Tonight, we have associates, consultants, organizers, life coaches, and Tony is author of Aura Visions and shares various topics of the Ascension Awakening Conscious Oracles Club with his wife, who is the president of our ACO, our Authors Club organization. Now, her name is Bonnie Lenore Elliott, and we welcome them every Saturday if they're choosing to come on, but for whatever reasons, they've been moving, folks, so I don't know if their computers are down or what, but we'll try to see what we can come up with tonight for a decent show. Now, I am Teresa J. Morris. I'm known pretty much for being an investigator, reporter, psychic medium, author, speaker, spiritual social entrepreneur, and minister of the Ascension Center Organization, or what we call Ascension Universal Life, as a community online awakening skills and the light workers and truth seekers that we know share life teachings as a community online practicing skills to support the Ascension Spiritual Intentional Community supporting sustainability. Now, Tony, if you're not going to be here tonight, I'm going to change the topic tonight, and we may still do some ET spirit readings. Tom, you want to come on and help me tonight? Tony's not here. I'm going to put, where is it? Well, grab mine. I'll put you on here tonight, and we can discuss something that, grab mine over on the fireplace. I'm going to get my husband to come on tonight. We haven't had Tom on for a year, at least a year, and or thereabouts in 2013. So I don't know if Tony's coming, but Tom is the Ascension Center and Ace Folk Life founder with me, being that he's my husband, so he has to put up with all phone calls and the people and the radio show and all the book editing that we do. And it's time a lot of new people get to know him. I'll put him in the listing here, and Ace Folk Life and the ACO Metaphysics. But Tom has got a lot of military training that we all wish we could have had. And he went through a time when, let me put U.S. Army, and he was friend to President Reagan. Actually, he was Agent Morris, but what we can do is ask him to come on, because we share folk life, we share as history, American history, and I will put, because that's what it is now, our lives that we've lived is now history, if we choose it to be so, and if we're allowed to share it, and this is an archive place. So American culture, is something that we lived, and not everybody knows our stories. And American culture education would be good for ACE. And he does ACO and ACE with me. And I guess what we'll do is instead of Curious Conscious, we'll change it to ACO and ACE. Maybe I'll change it ACO-ACAR, American Culture Investigative Reporting. And he's had some alien contact, which not everybody has, and he's got some interesting stories to tell. Tom, you coming on? Okay, I'll bring it to you. I've got to. You're going to have to hold on, folks, because I called it out, honey. It's 347-945-72, says, let me go take it to him, folks. I have to baby my husband. You know how it is, women. They want to be spoon-fed. So he left his phone in the car, so I've got to go get him my phone, and I got to give him the call-in number, and we'll get all this squared away here and just discuss. He's good for a good story. He told me a good one at dinner tonight. Maybe he'll want to repeat it. It's one of the many times he went to the White House and flew over from Germany. But he's got some interesting stories to tell. And being that we are live and on the air at prime time, I think it'd be good fun time to hear some of his stories and how we got together. It's very interesting in itself, because there you go. Here, just call me. Oh, 347-94. Did I bring you the number? 945-7207. He even want me to dial the number. He's whining and dialing. Oh Lordy, he's a good person. Tony, where are you tonight? You weren't on last night because it was your birthday. And anyway, that's okay. I'm good at tap dancing, I guess one could say. I'm going to get my husband to come in. I got a new beagle. If you hear her, she's a little whiny. She's real sweet. She'll come up and meet you when you come in, shake your hand. But she's a worrier. She's, if I'm not right where she needs me to be, she gets all worried. Oh, we had fun last night. We were doing readings, and so I pulled out the old tarot cards, and we're back in business again, folks, and that's a lot of fun. And anyway, we're all about our Ascension Awakening Conscious Club, and I've had out-of-body near-death experiences, and I go to places Tom hasn't been, but he's actually been off planet in ways that others just can only dream of, and you could say he's an original astronaut. That's what my kids call it. And we share community online practicing skills to support the Ascension Spiritual Intentional Communities, supporting sustainability. Now, we're all about golden age of cosmology, and friends are always searching together on the spiritual path. We have various friends. My group, TeresaJMorris.org, check it out if you will. That's TheresaJMorris.org or TeresaJMorris.com. And we have our unique business and social networking together. And we're co-creating together a spiritual plane of life and synchronicity as students and teachers here to connect our everybody's soul purpose is to love the higher power source, our God and Godmother, both male and female, is the way I look at it, because we're all both left and right brain, and we all have a mother and father in this lifetime. And we can talk about things that are curious that may not be known and get it on record tonight. America's culture education. Now, I'm going to put the Reagan era, because a lot of people love the Reagan era, and that's one thing he's good at. And a lot of people like those stories they never were able to be involved in unless they were in the president's Oval Office or maybe the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But the Reagan era, and I'll put Cold War. Of course, that's what was going on since after World War II, right? Cold War, I guess missions? Or, I don't know if I should put missions. But anyway, I'm going to get my husband on here, and we'll just see what story he would like to tell. Okay, hi, Thomas R. Morris, and also known as Tom Morris, my husband. How are you tonight, sir?
better than I was, I guess.
Good. Could you speak up a little bit? And would you like to introduce yourself? I'd like to hear this year's 2014. Now, remember, you are the Ace Folk Life founder with me. And, of course, you're an author. And you have military, many schools from 1980 to 93. I've got Thomas R. Morris, the Reagan era dash Cold War. But let's start. We've only done like one or two stories in 2013. But why don't you give people an idea of how many schools you were able to get? Because a lot of people, this is old history. It's what, 80 would be, this is 2014. So about 24 years ago when you went in. That's a long time ago. You want to talk about it?
Actually, from 80, 90, 2000, about 34 years I went in the service 34 years ago.
You're not that old, baby, are you?
1980 is when I went in, and this is 2014 added up.
Ooh, 30.
From 80 to 90.
34 years ago? Whoa.
Yeah.
So how old are you now?
I'm 54.
You're 54 years young on planet Earth. Prior military, and so much has changed since we were in, but you helped change that. You were one of the movers and shakers, and people like you and me didn't know we couldn't do things, so we did them anyway, but we went, got things done, and you helped with what's called now Homeland Security. What was that bill called that we now use? It was anti-terrorist, so that's one story I know people may want to hear, because it's helped a lot of things, because you went through things that people had no idea that was going on in hurting our military and back in 1980. So you were 20 years old. You were in Texas. You were recruited out of Texas. Where did you go through basic training? Or did you go to MEPS? Like in Houston is where I thought I joined the first time. Of course, I was told I was a 4x10 rehire in the United States Navy, but I had been a contractor prior to that out of being an investigator in Birmingham, Alabama, working various cases in arson, fraud, and subrogation. But I lost that, a lot of my memories from back to 1967, unless something comes up to tweak it. But you know all about that kind of stuff, too. So where do you want to start? I guess start with 1980, because that's sort of where your history of America and the President Reagan stories begin. Now, you went through MEPS where? Texas? Shreveport? Where?
I went through what?
Military Enlisted Processing?
Oh, yeah. Shreveport, Louisiana.
Shreveport, Louisiana. I'm a Louisiana girl, folks. Monroe, Louisiana. So real close to where I was and where I was born. But when you went through there, I was had just moved up to Birmingham, Alabama, was in the University of Alabama. So you were just joining, because you and I both worked Reagan when he got shot. But I met Reagan, President Reagan, in Houston, Texas, on a personal note, when I was prior married to the father of my children. And I remember meeting him with all the black suits, Secret Service around him. And I was on the list and approved prior to go to these fancy parties that I'm sure you remember. And this was, I guess, to get him elected. But I met him in Houston, Texas. I met, Bush, Reagan, both. But so 1980, what made you join the Army? Can you remember?
Well, I always wanted to be in the Army, and it was just time, so I joined, served my country. Didn't expect what happened, but it did, and it was just a course of things happening at different times that got me where I went. And sometimes today I regret that I did it, and the other time, I mean, I'm always proud of what I've, you know, served my country, but There were aspects of it that I wished I didn't had to do, but I did them.
Well, your recruiter talked you into a couple of classes. It's how do you say it? A paratrooper or something? You mentioned tonight there was two classes, but you went through several schools because you were a good sharpshooter, what I called in one of our shows, Kentucky Windage. But tell us a little bit about those schools that your recruiter got you to, and then go through some of the schools that they got you to go through while you were waiting. They said they were full. What were those two schools, and it was written into your contract?
I enlisted originally to be airborne air assault, and it was
airborne
in my contract
air assault
that I would go to those two schools. If I hadn't went, it would have been a breach of contract, and they would have had let me out with a servant's pay. So I was on hold, and I went through basic and AIT at Fort Benning, Georgia, and I was on hold until those schools come available. Well, Fort Benning is the forefront training facility for the U.S. infantry, Army infantry, and so all the infantry schools are located at, for the most part, there in Fort Benning, Columbus, Georgia. So while I was on hold and standby, I went to each school and talked to the commandant of each school and got in on a space available situation on each one of the schools. If there was a space, I got the school. If there was, and I didn't. And I ended up attending 23 military infantry type schools in the first year that I was in the Army before I ever reported to my first duty station, which was in Wiesbaden, West Germany. And that was because I was waiting on the airborne air assault school. You know what I mean? That's just what it was.
And you went through demolitions and sniper and some of the schools that not everybody gets to go through. But you were number one, and right out of basic boot camp, you went to Georgia, didn't you? From Shreveport, you did basic in Georgia?
Yeah. I did what they call AIT, individual training, in Georgia, and then I went to demolitions in Georgia and sniper and
North Carolina.
Went to Pathfinder. I done several schools in North Carolina and several schools in Fort Bragg. And of course, airborne is at Fort Bragg, airborne is at Fort Benning, Georgia, and air assault is in Fort Campbell, Kentucky.
Fort Campbell, Kentucky, over here where we live, folks. We're in Beaver Dam, Kentucky, between Fort Knox and Fort Campbell. That's where we're broadcasting to you live tonight. That's our point of origin for tonight. Now, regarding you, and I know it's hard to remember everything, but I remember everything in boot camp for me and my school, Hospital Corpsman. Of course, I was already in security and intelligence and been trained, as I mentioned earlier, arson, fraud, subrogation, but I did a lot of investigations with the FBI and working on cases, and we would be assigned to individual cases. But let's talk about get your schools out of the way for the record. So this way we can do it chronologically, and that way we sort of know where we are in your life. So right now we're about, his birthday was May 16th, 1980, and he was on a plane after MEPS going, flying over to boot camp in Georgia, right? Somewhere in Georgia?
No, I joined the Army in January of 1980, before my 21st birthday. I turned 21 in Fort Benning, Georgia. After basic, I was on standby for other schools when I turned 21.
We have a picture of you back then. We can scan and put into the archives and on your Facebook page.
I think I've got one stashed away somewhere, but it doesn't look like me anymore.
Yeah.
But
I'm
a whole lot older and hopefully a little wiser.
Yeah, we've all changed. So you're saying 34 years ago, it's almost 50 years. We only got a few years, 15 more years to go if we're alive then. But at least some people will get to know, may remember these times, and maybe they even served with you. And if they see your name as Thomas R. Marsh, Reagan-era Cold War in Space, they may be able to find you.
I doubt if any of them would want to. I'm afraid that the relationships I had while I was in the Army didn't hold all good memories. And when I first got out, we would have a reunion. And every time that we met, every year, we'd meet different places. And it would eventually come around to the stuff that every one of us wanted to forget. And we'd remember them all and have nightmares on top of nightmares over it for 6 months after we had our little get-together, so we finally said, well, we've had enough of this. There's no need of keeping the wounds open, so we stopped. I haven't talked to or seen any of the men I served with for a long, long time. I was unfortunate enough, or the colonel himself was unfortunate enough to meet me during Desert Storm. We didn't quite see eye to eye over some mess food. I saw him last year. He just happened to come by, and I seen him. He didn't recognize me, but I recognized him. He hadn't changed a whole lot from the time he was a colonel in the U.S. Army. I think he was still reserve. I'm not sure. Didn't ask. Like I said, we weren't on the best of terms, and there was no need of bringing up old wounds, so I just kept my mouth shut. But he's the only one out of all the soldiers that I knew back then that I've ever run across. So,
well, it's a good time to bring up my USAA, means United Service Automobile Association, its affiliates. But they say VFW, Veterans of Foreign Wars. No one does more for veterans, a cherished legacy. So we're being talked about as VFW now. But veterans, we all have memories, some good, some bad. Mine were all good because mine was all about education, training, serving, and working together as a unit. Now, one of the stories that I know you can tell with all your schools, do you want to run through a list of basic names just so people can get an idea how much training you had? And you were number one in your demolitions and in your sniper school, right?
I graduated number one in both schools. graduated number 3 in air assault and 2 in airborne. I could jump out of a perfect good plane pretty good and jump out of a helicopter on the end of a rope like a spider pretty good. And then I like blowing up things, so I was pretty good at that.
What about Ranger School?
Yeah, I went through Ranger School. It was interesting, to say the least. I also went through a Navy school that most Army don't go through. That was a joint effort that I coordinated as an experiment. And that was diver school. I went through diver and underwater explosive school.
Oh, did you go?
The Navy.
I went to Hawaii over on the island.
I took my training. I reported to Navy Yard in Norfolk, Virginia.
Oh, okay,
and
East Coast.
Took me to a. Yeah, they took me to a facility that was basically off the beaten path, and that's where I went to school.
We wore blue t-shirts and khaki shorts.
Stay again.
Scuba gear. What'd you wear?
I wore Army issue military uniforms, other than scuba gear or. Something like that, which I wore a lot of scuba gear because we did a lot of underwater activities.
You mean the black suits? You wore the black suits? My brother wore that. Yeah, we just did it in the swimming pool.
No, we did it in the ocean. We'd be
we were
on
all surrounded by ocean.
Speedboat, and they'd yank us up out of the water when they come by. And
oh, yeah.
If you weren't
my brother
sore, as far as you was dead, then you would fall off the side of one of them same boats to dive. And had to go down and disassemble or defuse. Not disassemble, but defuse.
That's more like Navy SEAL training.
Right.
Isn't it?
And Navy SEALs go through it as well. But they call it underwater demolitions.
You did underwater demolition. Yeah, I didn't have that.
Yeah,
you're a little more extensive than learning how to use scuba gear in a swimming pool.
I was a demolition specialist in the Army, and to further that education, I got the underwater demolition school. And they had to teach you to scuba dive first. I mean, kind of hard to disable a bomb underwater if you don't know how to use scuba gear. So I went through scuba training and then went to the underwater demolitions. A lot of Navy SEALs go through the underwater demolitions. It's not as... they don't cover as much for the SEALs as they do for if that was going to be your special job in the Navy, they had what they call an advanced course, and that's all you did was underground demolitions. You'd set bombs and disassemble them and all that.
When did you learn to fly?
Did that during the same year on my off days. I'd go to the civilian airport and take course. You know, I took a course in aviation, and then I got my pilot's wings with fixed wing aircraft, and then I kept increasing the size of aircraft by going to classes and civilian classes and paying for it out of my pocket. And I went through chopper school, and I got my pilot license to fly small choppers. And then I turned all that paperwork into the Army, and I had to take several written exams and several physicals, and finally the Army granted me the license to fly military aircraft. I could fly anything from a crop duster to Boeing 747, or in the Army, the C-5, which is the largest cargo aircraft in the world. I never flew one, understand, a reality. I flew it in, what they call them machines. It's a training aid. It's similar. And but I never flew a real C-5. I've been on many of them, but I've never flown it.
Well,
most
you did
of my schools happened
like,
the first year.
We both could do a Beechnut Cessna or helicopter, Bell, whatever, two-man. Did you learn to fly the helicopter for escort or for I know you worked with some Air Force, as did I. We both worked joint. We both worked with Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines. A lot of people don't know what that means, cross-training. I was a SAM or Sierra Mariner program. I did a lot of, like, beta testing and computers for all you computer geeks out there. But we did, we did a lot of simulation, didn't we? We were helped. But you actually did a lot in the field with all this special training and were worth a few million. I remember one of my briefings on you in the beginning. I think there was over $20 million, wasn't it, they priced you at an asset?
I'm not sure. I know I had a lot of training, and then a lot of it was OJT, which stands for on-the-job training. In other words, they put you out there, you get shot, and you survive. Well, they say, okay, you had the training. You know what I mean? If you get killed, well, you should have trained him better.
Well, you might want to mention that, who was it, Saddam Hussein, that had you had some money out there on you, $50,000 or so?
One time there was over $100,000 reward out on me, dead or alive.
$100,000 for your head, huh?
Yeah, during a desert storm. Needless to say, no one ever collected it. Of course, rumors, you know how superstitious people are, and rumors get going. I was known as the man that wouldn't die. I don't know if I could have, or I just wouldn't.
Wouldn't lay down. When you were in firefights, though, there's some pretty interesting stories there, but you guys didn't like to get together and talk about all the bad times. But let's go back in time right after you get all your training. Do you remember how many schools you actually had?
Well, like I said, the first year I went to 23 different military infantry-based schools. What I mean by infantry-based is you had to have an infantry MOS, which is 11 Bravo, in order to attend the schools. You couldn't be a 76 Tango, which is a supply clerk, and go to these schools. It wasn't open to just any MOS. You had to. So I went to just about all of them I could go to for the infantry based schools. There was 23 of them that I completed, and I completed in the top 10 of all of them. Meaning that I had the highest scores of the top 10 scores. The high scores, I was one of them. and on all my tests and hands-on and written. I call some of it luck, some of it was just plain determination, and some of it was because it was a subject that I truly enjoyed and failed in. I mean, be perfectly honest, I never did like jumping out of perfectly good airplanes. Most time I was ending up having to be shoved out, or might say throwed out, because I'd get to the door and freeze up. I couldn't make that final step, or I could have, but I wouldn't, and I'd end up, somebody'd have to be behind me and kick me out the door, so to speak. So, well, once I got out there, I was good to go. It was just, that initial step was just, too much like suicide. I just couldn't make myself do it, as my little nephew said. You know, I can't make me do it.
Well, let's talk about Operation Eagle Claw. That was 24 to 25 April 1980. Operation Eagle Claw, or Operation Evening Light, or Operation Ricefall, was an American military operation ordered by the United States President Jimmy Carter to attempt to end the Iran, some people say Iran in the South, I ran my race and I wrecked my body, is a song, Iran hostage crisis by rescuing 52 Americans held captive at the United States Embassy in Tehran, Iran, on 24 April 1980. Its failure and the humiliating public debacle that ensued damaged American prestige worldwide. Carter and many experts conclude that the failure to free the hostage played a major role in Ronald Reagan's victory in the 1980 United States presidential election. The operation encountered many obstacles and was eventually aborted. There were 8 helicopters sent to the first staging area, Desert One, but only 5 arrived in operational condition. One encountered hydraulic problems, another got caught in a cloud of what they say was very fine sand, and the last one showed signs of a cracked rotor blade. So we were all frustrated with our equipment back then, and during planning it was decided that the mission would be aborted if fewer than 6 helicopters remained, despite only 4 being absolutely necessary. But there is a movie out about it, and a move that is still discussed in military circles. The commanders asked President Carter for permission to abort, and Carter granted the request. As the U.S. force prepared to leave, one of the helicopters crashed into a transport aircraft, which contained both servicemen and jet fuel. The resulting fire destroyed both aircraft and killed 8 servicemen. It was one of Delta Force's first missions. But you were just coming in. There were 8 killed, 4 wounded, 1 helicopter, 1 transport aircraft destroyed, and 5 helicopters abandoned. After that, we got a little better with the Joint Task Force, with the Army Major General James B. Vaught, but and Commander Charlie Beckwith. A lot of people may remember them, the Marine Lieutenant Colonel Edward Seifert. But the Tehran CIA Special Activities Division, they had a paramilitary team led by retired U.S. Army Special Forces Richard J. Meadows. Now, as I said, there has been a movie made about that. But you came in right with President Reagan on that, and that's how you guys met. Was your first big plane trip that you were chosen for because you were green, right out of all these fancy schools, and it was your first overseas trip in the back of a big plane. What kind of plane was that, your big first flight across the ocean?
It was we called a C-130. A transport plane, a medium transport plane, and there was weapons loaded on it. That was classified then, and it's still classified. So,
you think it's still classified?
I know it'll be classified until hell freezes over.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, I know that this is a big thing. A big movie was made with the U.S. Air Force, Army, Navy, Marine Corps, And I don't know much about the movie. I didn't see it, and I don't think you did. But anyway, okay, so you can't talk about those details? I didn't know that. But anyway,
yeah.
President Reagan called you over for your first, and I think we've covered some of it. Maybe you listened to the last show we did last year. We could pick up about that. But that, is that when you met President Reagan, was about that classified?
Actually, no. I got my orders from one of Reagan's aides, and later I found out that Reagan had no knowledge of the weapons for hostages program. At the time, I thought he was informed of it and was all for it. Found out later that he had no knowledge of it until it was all over with.
So he was asking you what happened, right?
Yeah, but I didn't see Reagan with that happening. I met Ronald Reagan in August of 81. He took office in January, and I met him in August of 81. And
I was approved
involved.
67 and then met him sometime between 77, 79 in Houston while he was getting ready to run. You know, he was already running for president, already had Secret Service around him, which is, I don't understand how that was. But anyway, he was, I guess because he was running for president, they assigned Secret Service?
Yeah, I suppose so. There are,
well, anyway, so
if you become president, you'll have Secret Service the rest of your life, period.
All right, well, some reason you and I got involved with Reagan and then Bush. We both worked for Reagan, and then we both worked for Bush. But in Cheney, so we've got all this information in our heads, but they overlapped, we found out, but through the Pentagon and how we were matched up for various missions. But I don't know, there's a lot we've talked about, but let's do your history in the 80s, because that's pretty interesting, because it gets even more interesting as we go along chronologically on your timeline. So now you have done all these things and already had a classified mission before you even meet President Reagan, and you're saying he didn't even know anything, but President Carter and all of his group on the Democratic side, you know, President Reagan, Tom, was, I know you weren't politically briefed or understood political parties. I don't even know if you ever voted before you went to the voting booth to vote before you went in the military. Did you ever even vote, go to a booth and vote in Texas or Louisiana?
Before I went into service, I never voted, but you got to remember, I didn't go into the service till I was 20 years old.
You could have voted at 18, but I can't say that I remember voting at 18. I was asked that on Facebook, and I can't remember the year I first voted. You know, I don't remember. But anyway, so we were programmed in our military service based on who was president at the time. So we were indoctrinated under the Republican Party, for those of you out there. But really, when you're in the military, you don't ascribe or subscribe to being a card-carrying political follower or voter, because Tom and I claim to be independent voters. And so we don't vote like Republican or Democrat. However, we were sworn to our president and our country to protect. And Tom, you want to explain that a little bit?
When you go into the military, you take an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States. You're not actually working for the party that's in office. You're working for the good of all Americans. And that's the way most soldiers look at it. they have their opinions on who would be good at, you know, presidents and who wouldn't. I mean, they are American men and women, and they vote every year, and but it doesn't matter who wins, because for a soldier, his job is to follow the orders of the commander-in-chief, which is the president of the United States. It doesn't say you have to follow the Democratic president and not the Republican president. It says you have to follow the orders of the president, period. So that's the way it is for soldiers. You can vote for whoever you want to, but you're going to obey the orders you've given by any president or a man that's elected president of the United States. And I, for one, and I think most men and women that join the military take the oath extremely serious and uphold it to the best of their ability. They came out with a song, "I'm Proud to Be an American, and I'd Stand Up Next to You and Defend Her Still Today." Well, I'm that way. I'm in very, very bad health, and I can't hardly stand. But if the United States called me up and said, "Mr. Morris, the United States is in a pickle. We need you back on active duty," and I'd go. If they had to strap me in a wheelchair and roll me out of the plane to fly to parachute into a situation, I guess I would do it, because that's they have an old saying, "Old soldiers never die; they just smell that way." And
well, I've got a question: when the men in black, after you're out in 89-3, and we'll get back on that timeline, but I've got to jump on the future. You and I, after we worked for the military 1980 to 1993, I was brought in from Hawaii by the Pentagon or the Men in Black or whomever as a contractor or government. I signed some new papers in Fort Hood through, you know, I had Three Corps, and then I had to take another ASVAB at Fort Hood. And Navy papers, which was strange to me being at Fort Hood, but the Navy, you know, they crossed. And I know that was strange to me, you know, to be on the military base.
I can't hear you.
Okay. When 1980 to 93, right after that, we drove trucks.
I can't hear you.
Hold on. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Huh. All right, 1980 to 1993. You can hear me now?
Yeah.
All right, it's delayed a little bit. We drove trucks, and some men in black approached you at one of the, I believe that was 2003, and it was regards to a paper that, or a big manual or something for anti-terrorist before it was Homeland Security. And they were wanting you to assist them with writing. Was it the fact that they did not present their credentials to you? Because I know how you are proud to be American. And you do wear your Army hat. And we went to eat tonight, and you wore your military. We were talking about the pickle suit and the camouflage that came through, even though it's not Desert Storm gray brown. You wear the green. But they approached you about papers that you went before Congress for later on after our 80 to 93 in the military, and you said you couldn't help them. Why could you not help them, being that you're so proud to be an American?
I helped write some rules, regulations, and directives on how to combat terrorism in the United States and against Americans abroad. and that was in the 80s, and it was approved by Congress, and it was adopted, I should have said.
Wasn't that your idea? Because things were going terribly.
Originally, it was, and I was fortunate to be assigned to Israel for a short period of time, and I worked with their anti-terrorist organization, and I learned a lot of their attitude about terrorism and how to combat it, and I agreed with it. I mean, it was harsh. It was iron-fisted. No mistakes. If you made a terrorist act against Israel, you was going to pay with your life. That was no ifs, ands, buts, maybes, or might. That's what was going to happen. And it deterred a lot of terrorist activity against Israel because they knew the consequences, the terrorists did, and they wasn't willing to pay them consequences. So I adopted a lot of theirs, and some of it the Congress decided was too harsh, and we had to negotiate and get rid of some and add a little bit or tone down some of it and don't just go out, all right, this guy's a terrorist, go shoot him. Congress didn't agree on that part of a plan. They didn't want to be judge, jury, and executor.
Would you remember what year in your chronological order, 1980 to 1993, what year that was?
I believe I wrote the draft in 84, and then in 85 we had that joint. Well, and it wasn't a joint; it was just a task force, a military task force. As a matter of fact, it was all military that actually wrote the policy, the anti-terrorist policy, and of course Reagan endorsed it, and it went through Congress, and Congress approved it. It took a while to get it approved, and I went to talk to Congress, I believe it was twice, on that subject, trying to get that bill passed, and I got it passed, and then shortly after they passed that, or just before they passed the terrorist law, the Marines got blown up in I can't remember the name of the country now. 200-some Marines were killed in their beds. And that's what kind of pushed it over the edge. When them Marines were killed by terrorists, it pushed the terrorist bill through the House and Senate and Congress.
Would you be talking about Beirut barracks bombing in March 8, 1995? A truck bombing blew up in Beirut, killing more than 80 people.
Yeah, they passed the bill right after that happened.
Well, let's see. That was 1983 when the barracks bombing happened. The United States Embassy bombing was a suicide bombing in Beirut, Lebanon, and it killed 63 embassy and CIA staff members. So Beirut Memorial, let's see. Beirut barracks. Now, that was, I think we talked about that, part of the Lebanese Civil War. A smoke cloud rises from the rubble of the bomb barracks at the Beirut International Airport. Now, this was October 23rd, 1983, Beirut, Lebanon. Two truck bombs struck separate buildings.
That was the one that turned the Of course, it wasn't looking good for the bill. It looked like it wasn't going to pass. As a matter of fact, I doubt if it would have, if that bombing hadn't taken place. Once that bombing took place and it hit the news, Congress even had special session to pass the anti-terrorist bill, which put the regulations that me and others had written into law. Prior to that, I went to Congress twice trying to convince them it was a good idea and all that, but like I said, I don't think it would have ever passed if that bombing in Beirut hadn't happened.
Well, that timeline is June 6, 82, Israel invaded Lebanon, Operation Peace for Galilee, and then 23 August, 82, Bashir Gamal was elected president, and then 25 October, 82, 400 French, 800 Italian soldiers and 800 Marines of the 32nd Marine Amphibious Unit were deployed in Beirut as used as peacekeeping overseas. And then, then 10 September 82, the PLO retreats from Beirut, M&F protection. But I don't know if you remember this, but on 14 September 82, Lebanon's president, Bashir Gamal, was assassinated. And then the Sabra and Shatila massacres, 16 September to 18, and Amin Gamal was elected Lebanon's president. Remember, Lebanon is Marlo Thomas, who you like, over at the St. Jude. Danny Thomas, who we used to watch Make Room for Daddy, he was Lebanese, right? But they called it Mission Creep. Israel initiated Operation Peace for Galilee. But all this seems to have something to do with this force and explosion lifted the entire four-story structure, sharing the bases of a concrete support column measuring by numerous 1¾-inch steel rods. My goodness, the U.S. Marine Corps barracks in Beirut in 1982. So you're saying all this sort of transpired together from those two trucks that came through with explosives, right? The death toll was 241 American servicemen, 220 Marines, 18 sailors, and 3 soldiers. And that was the deadliest single-day toll for the United States Marine Corps since World War II, Battle of Iwo Jima. So, yeah, that was pretty important.
Get your mouth away from the mic, and I can't hear you over the phone. But, yes, don't reread it. That took time period. Like I said, I didn't write it by myself. I take no claim in it, and the original question, if you remember, was why I didn't help the men that came
asked me to
review and renew the terrorist policy. I had been out of the game and for quite some time by then, and I didn't know the players, and I didn't know the logistics as I did then, because I was involved in it then, and I knew.
So you had done that.
I can't hear you again.
You had done the paper in 84, and they came to you 20 years later in 2004, apparently wanting something updated after 2001. You can't hear me?
No, I can. You got to put your mouth to the mic. But, yes, that's the way it happened. And that's why I told them, I said, you need to get someone that is up to speed on what's been happening and what actions has already been taken and what actions need to be taken. I don't know, because I've been out of the business too long. And so, therefore, I don't think I would be a good candidate to help you. And that's why I didn't take the job.
All right. So that's why, for the history, when Thomas R. Morris, after many years of service and was out driving a truck, and there's a whole history of how we met, but I'm glad to get that on. Now, let's go back to your chronological order after, because I want to get people to how you actually met Reagan again. We had that one time. People like the Reagan stories. And I told you, Patsy Reagan, his daughter, is writing for Amazon, right, are writing books and publish them through CreateSpace, which I want to do for you and your history if we ever get it down like we are on using these radio archives. It'll give you an idea of what it is we need chronologically. And chronologically, after 80 and 81 to 83, we're about 83, 84, but there were several missions you were reported on. But let's talk about after you've flown back into country, or were you in Germany when President Reagan, you first meet President Reagan? I thought it was over the pins out of the weapons is how
no.
you met him.
No.
Okay.
I got involved quite by accident on how the event that ended up capturing a terrorist that actually he didn't fit any bombs, but he would supply ammunition, explosives, weapons, and information to those who did blow up things and kill people.
Oh, you're talking about a terrorist that you just happened to be. That was your first. You
right,
were right, right.
After he'd been on the wanted list for over 10 years, and I was part of the task force that got him caught red-handed with stolen plans in his hands, and seen to it that he got life imprisonment.
Was that over the plane that looks like Gus?
No, this was the Wolfgang. I call him Wolfgang for simple reason is I don't use real names. But he was a terrorist information broker. And they've been wanting him for over 10 years, and I helped
Wasn't
capture
it the F-22? I don't know where that's coming up in my brain. It's called the Raptor.
No,
no, not the Raptor. That was Martin.
The bait that we used was a blueprint, detailed blueprint, of what he believed was the stealth bomber.
Oh, the stealth. What was that called? F-17? Darn it. I'm getting
not
old.
Sure. I'm not
yeah,
sure.
I can't remember. But anyway, folks, you know, it's the one that looks, it's the one we all see on TV. I thought it was F-17, but maybe not. That was for.
Anyway, it was the bait. The plans that I sold him, or supposedly sold him, the plane would have never flown if it had been built by them planes. And they
stealth
was other,
aircraft.
Yeah, it, there was a lot of.
It was F-117, wasn't it? F-117, Lockheed Martin?
Know.
Oh, you don't know? Yeah,
no.
The F-117 was the Nighthawk, 1981 to 2008. It looks like Gus, the UFO. Like a boomerang, black
yeah.
boomerang. Yeah, that's the stealth.
But anyway, that was what we used to capture him. That was the bait. And they sent me to Washington, D.C. to meet the president, and the president was going to award me a medal for... duty above and beyond the kind of call of duty, bravery, I think it said, bravery be above and beyond the call of duty. That's one of the favorite things that the Army always put on their medals to make it sound good.
So he, because you caught this terrorist that had been on this thing for 10 years, and y'all baited him with the F-117 Night Colt Stealth Strike Air Force plane, or one similar, but y'all called it the Stealth because none of us back then knew about it, the stealth aircraft. But it had conventional radar to detect and track. But anyway, the black boomerang aircraft that was reversed.
We've already answered that three times, Teresa, yes.
All right, well, I'm just trying to make sure we know that's the stealth. Now, from that, he brought you over. Is that you were going to meet him, he was going to pin you, and somebody shot at him or something, didn't he? And you had to respond?
No.
That was a different story.
Well, it's the same story, but yes, I went to the White House, and he, shook my hand and congratulated me and thanked me for a job well done and all that happy horse crap. It was a little dog and pony show. They had reporters taking pictures and all that good stuff.
So we could find pictures of you back then if we looked hard?
No. I requested for Reagan to take pictures, not to let them be published because it would damage my abilities in the field.
So you had them get rid of the pictures in the media? Can the president do that?
Well, I imagine he had to call in a few favors, but he got it accomplished. And yes, I had him do that because if people knew what I looked like and it would be all over the world within, hours, I would be useless in the field because everybody said, oh, no, wait a minute.
Agent Morris or Sergeant
he's
Morris.
He's put down Wolfgang. Stay the hell away from him. But anyway.
So in your mind's eye, that's how you met him, was being pinned. But I think was it the last story where you got shot, or did we ever record that? We only recorded like one.
We didn't. They pinned the medal on me there in the Oval Office. And this so happened, Reagan was having a political party dinner. There's going to be a lot of congressmen, senators, foreign dignitaries and stuff at this big dinner. And one of the many banquet halls is in Washington, D.C. And I was invited or told that I would come to that dinner.
Is that when they put you in the Watergate? They put you
yes,
in the Watergate?
Yes, I was staying at Watergate at the time.
But the banquet hall was somewhere else. It wasn't at the Watergate, right?
No, it was the government banquet hall. It's what it was built for presidents to have banquets in it.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, I was informed that I had to go. Well, I had one or two options. I could wear civilian blue jeans and shirt or my military dress greens. Well, the problem was I was a Spec 4, an E-4, a lonely E-4. And I had E-4 stripes on my dress greens. So they assigned a lieutenant to me, a female lieutenant, and she had me fitted for five suits. I'm not sure how to pronounce the name of them, Armani
or something
Armani?
Like that. Giorgio Armani?
Yeah. Suits. And she ordered five of them. They come and fit me, and brought the sewing machines and fixed one right there. So I would have it for that night. And I went to the banquet and while we was in the banquet, I was sitting at the presidential table. And I noticed this guy kept trying to position himself where he would have a clean view or a clean shot at the president. Well, I had been through sniper school and several other schools, and I knew what he was doing. When I seen him doing it, I knew that he was setting himself up in a position that he could kill the president and in the commotion get away. So I quietly excused myself from the table like I had to go to the men's room or something. And I worked my way in behind him. And at the time, I didn't have a weapon. So I had taken a magazine and rolled it up real tight. And I walked up behind him and I stuck that magazine in his back and told him to keep his hands away from his body or I'd trigger. It probably, to him, felt like a silencer up against his back. At least that's what I was hoping he'd think. And he evidently thought it because he very quietly went with me to the hall and out of the banquet room. Secret Service was there, and I told them, and they freaked him down. They found a pistol with a silencer on it, and he was whisked away. And, of course, the Secret Service is bound by law to notify the president that there had been a situation, and it was resolved. You know, they was an attempt on his life, which was done away with. So the senior officer of the Secret Service informed Reagan before I even got back to the table. And he told him that I had spotted the terrorist or the man that was about to try to kill him, and that I had quietly removed him from the facility and turned him over to the Secret Service. So Reagan knew all this, and when I returned to the table, After the meal, and he had his speech done, and a couple others had big speeches and all that, and he had come to a close. And they rushed Reagan out through the side door and into the limo and back to the White House. And the senior aide for Reagan came and told me that the Secret Service was going to take me back to the White House from the banquet hall that Reagan, President Reagan, wanted to see me that night. Well, I have said it several times. If you've ever been to one of them banquets, it wouldn't keep a mouse alive what they feed you, so I was extremely hungry. I was a growing boy, so to speak. I was, 21 years old? And so we got in the car, and of course I had this female lieutenant as my date, I guess you could call her. And she was basically there to make sure I used the proper fork for my salad and use the proper hands to eat. So and how to taste the wine, not go as lit, and stuff like that. Make sure I didn't get any spots on my white shirt. Anyway,
she sent your shoes to be polished. you had shoes that matched your Armani suits and your ties and everything, right? She laid all that out for you. And when you had a suite at the Watergate, she got the other room at the suite, and she accompanied you as your military attaché.
Okay. That's not part of the story. I mean, yes, she was. But anyway, I asked her when we got in the car, I said, look, I'm about to starve. Let's stop at a restaurant or something and get us a bite to eat before we go to the White House. And she says, you can't keep the president waiting. That's just unheard of. No, you can't do that. So I tapped on the glass, and the Secret Service driver let the glass down. And I said, hey, man, drive through McDonald's. He said, excuse me? I said, drive through McDonald's. I'm going to get something to eat. Now you can either drive through the drive-thru and I can get it and eat it on the way to the White House, or park this damn car and I'll go in and get it. But I'm going to eat. I'm hungry. It ain't going to kill him to wait for 5 minutes while I scarf down a Big Mac. So he went through the drive-thru with his long limousine and I ordered a Big Mac and fries or something, you know, a chocolate shake or whatever, and I ordered the two security, Secret Service meal and the lieutenant. And we got up there. Well, I paid for it all. We got back there and we sorted it out. Gave him his hamburgers up front. We had ours. We munched out. And he drove us on to the White House.
Did you park the limo to eat or did he eat, keep going?
No, he kept driving, but he ate. I watched him through the glass. It was funny. I mean, he was just like I was. He about to starve to death. And, of course, they're not allowed to eat at them banquets or nothing. They, you know, they're on duty. They're supposed to be.
Well, Nancy Reagan and Patsy Reagan will probably enjoy these stories before you get to meet and really work with their, you know, with her hubby and her dad, you know. Pretty good stories. All right, so you're eating your hamburger and you're on the way to meet President Reagan the second time in your life, right? You haven't left
Washington. Actually, it would be the third time because I met him once in the Oval Office, and then I met him that night at the banquet, and then I was going to the White House to meet with him for the third time that day.
Wow.
Three
times in one day.
Everybody said that was unheard of, you know, that no one met the president for the first time three times in within a 12-hour period.
Yeah, you set a record.
You know, I didn't ask to see him, any of them, you know. It wasn't my idea. But anyhow, we went to the White House, so the Secret Service in the White House escorted me up to the, actually, it wasn't to the Oval Office this time. It was to the presidential apartment in the White House. And the lieutenant had to stay down in the holding area. It wasn't like a prison cell or anything. They had couches and recliners and candy machines and coffee and soda pop, and I mean they had it all down there. I mean it was a very comfortable waiting area. TV.
This is way before you found all the back secret stairways and that.
Yes.
In the White House.
This is 1981. My first real conversation with President Reagan, and of course I knocked on the door, and the butler answered the door, and I told him who I was, and he showed me to the study, and that's where I met with President Reagan in his home
was
for the
Nancy
first time.
Was Nancy there?
No, she was not in the study. There was a congressman, one or two congressmen in there. When I arrived, shortly after I got there, they left, and it was just me and Reagan and the Secret Service outside the door. They stood.
Now, Reagan didn't smoke, did he? But were you allowed to smoke?
He smoked a cigar once in a while. He would smoke a little bit of a cigar on special occasions with his glass of sherry or whatever, you know. Yes, I was allowed to smoke in his home, anywhere in the apartment.
Really?
They, not him, but the staff of Reagan didn't like for me to smoke in the Oval Office. Although on occasion I did. Now, of course, on occasion Reagan smoked cigar in the Oval Office.
Wow.
I don't think Nancy knew he smoked
cigars.
Like I said, he rarely did it. But every now and then he would smoke them.
Did you say Nixon?
No, Reagan.
Nancy. You don't think Nancy knew that he would sneak a cigar once in a while?
Right.
With his
sherry. He didn't really sneak it. He just smoked it. You know what I mean?
It wasn't
like
president.
He was hiding behind his desk smoking a cigar. I mean,
well, did the staff find out that he smoked a cigar, or did he hide it?
The staff knew that he smoked a cigar once in a while. Now, don't think that he smoked one after another one, or even smoked one a day, because he didn't. It was a special occasion. It's the only time he would smoke a cigar. And then he wouldn't smoke at all, maybe a third of it or a quarter of it, and he would...
Well, I bet it had to be the Cuban cigars back then, huh?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I just find that fascinating. I was never a smoker, even in the 50s and 60s and 70s growing up and 80s and 90s, but I just find that those little things curious. I don't know that they want that in the Reagan Library, but now Nancy will find out, or can, from our archives.
Oh, she may have known. I mean, I'm not saying that he tried to keep it from her. I'm just saying that I've never seen him smoke around her, although I did, and she never said a word about it. Matter of fact, she snapped her fingers and had the guy go get me an ashtray.
Wow. She cared about you, didn't she? She didn't want her carpet getting ruined.
Yeah, she didn't want me to stain her carpet.
All right, so anyway, we're on the first night you've met. You've saved his life for the first time. Of course, you do several times later. But, you know, this is going to be a story that we can keep going. Now, we've got about 36 minutes left on this two-hour period live on the air for people. But it's curious. I've changed it, folks, to ACOACAR. Thomas R. Morris, Meeting Pres Reagan, meaning President Reagan, 1980 to 1993, Untold History. So that's what we're going to call this for those that come to find it. And we're just now in beginning Tom's 13 years with President Reagan and, of course, President Bush afterwards, not so famous as President Reagan. But Tom and I both worked 80 to 93. So let's get back to the story where you're in the presence. You've had the Big Macs, and you've gone to the president's the White House and met him in his private study, which is part of his, what do they call that, the presidential townhouse suite apartment. Did they ever refer to it?
It's an apartment in the White House for the active president at the time. So when Reagan moved down to that apartment, Bush moved into it.
and Obama now, I guess, him and his wife. So it's where the whoever's president lives, right, in the White House.
Right, right.
And all of it's changed with all the security and computers and all the things we didn't have 1980 and 93. We didn't even have the Internet really officially yet. Windows 95 comes out in 95. So you guys, when you were in there, you didn't have all the computer and the high intel that we now see on the television show called Intelligence.
No, we didn't even have cell phones back in them days, especially cell phones with cameras on them.
Now, wait a minute. Back in 1989 and 1990, I had a cell phone, and I know we used those big old heavy bricks, you and I, in the military. You remember?
Yeah, we had them, but they weren't like they are today.
That's true. They were big, bulky.
Most of them were car phones where they were plugged up to the car for their power source. But they was not pocket size, and they were very bulky and inconvenient to use. And most of the time, there wasn't enough towers, so you know, if you was calling more than two blocks away, you might as well forget it and go find your phone.
Yeah, because we had to use phones.
Phone
even when we traveled in the 80s, and the military intelligence, our Pentagon, or whoever you want to say, the intelligence field, gave us telephones. Good old Ma Bell and AT&T and all of them, they knew more about what was going on than anybody. So you know we had
to
trust
them. But they had to be hooked up to a landline. I have one that you could use any landline you wanted to, and it had Velcro on it, and you would strap this thing to the receiver, and the receiver could, and then you could talk to another computer, but it had to be on a hard line. I mean, it wasn't a cell phone. We didn't have enough satellites, enough towers, and all that to handle the traffic that we have today. Back then, it was a new phenomenon, and it wasn't good reception or towers. You couldn't call from Germany to the States on a cell phone. It just couldn't happen. You had to have a hard line.
And that's why the government, and we work with contractors, including DARPA, D-A-R-P-A folks, and of course some of those guys have left and gone over to Google, like Ray Kurzweil. But anyway, so that's our little speech and infomercial for Ma Bell, AT&T, and the communication age back then, a little walk back in history when Tom and I were working for the government in uniform, out of uniform. I was a government contractor investigator and I've worked civilian and went through OPM, but I was chosen back in 1967. Tom physically was indoctrinated in 1980. I thought I was being re-recruited, 4x10, or a rehire, as they call it, but I went through 85 and 87, but I'd been in on paper since 67 in my NASA days back in Houston. But back to Tom. Now, we've been up there in the study with President Reagan, and he's impressed because the Secret Service has told him that my husband, Agent Thomas R. Morris, or Agent Morris, the president would never call you by your military name because he decided he wanted you to work for him because you'd saved his life when nobody else could. Somebody in the Secret Service was impressed, and it turned out you worked a lot after that night as agent because the Secret Service, he sort of mini assigned you like Secret Service. Nobody understood, including President Bush, how you got to be who you were. And I think we discussed a little bit of that in the last show, the last episode, and I'll have to go back last year. I didn't do them by episodes. I did them by date. But this year, this is episode 8 of season 3. But let me see. Tonight is Saturday, episode 8. And it was supposed to be Tony R. Elliott tonight, but instead it's Thomas R. Morris. So you were there in the study. We got sidetracked with little trivia, but I like the trivia of cigars, your cigarettes, meeting Nancy, or was Nancy there. Little things that sort of place and date the time, including there was no phones. That wasn't the night he gave you his personal phone number, but how did he get on to saying, hey, I want you to, I like you, and I want you to stick around? And you, did you say, sir, I got to go back to the to Germany, or I've got a contract with the Army? Because I had to tell intelligence agencies, I got a contract with the Navy. But somehow I think the psychologist said they were going to buy it.
He knew I was active duty Army, and no, it wasn't that night that I was told that I was a
liaison or agent?
Agent for President Reagan.
He didn't tell you that night. He waited a while.
Yeah, it was, a couple months later, Learjet picked me up and took me back to Washington. It was after the CIA had, well, I got involved with the CIA capturing Wolfgang. I was told that he said, well, I was a specialist then. I wasn't even a sergeant. I had just made specialist. And
okay.
The CIA man they sent from Washington to recruit me and to indoctrinate me, I guess you say, told me, he says, well, son, he said, you're in the CIA. It's in your blood now. It's the thrill of the game is what keeps you in it. And you'll find that without it, you will be a very miserable person.
Oh, so he told you, or he was trying to recruit you? This is before you went to see the director and found the bookcase and the book to pull out to get in up and down.
This was long. This is 1981 when I wasn't even in the Army, but maybe a little over a year. I joined the Army in 1980, January 1980, and this was, they arrested Wolfgang in August, I believe it was August the 3rd of 1981. And I don't know, maybe the 10th, I was in Washington, D.C., and that's when I met him and all that. So
around August 10th, 1981, that's pretty good date. So if you just pulled that out of your head,
well, that
pretty
would
accurate.
Be approximately, that would be approximately the date. It was a weekday that I met him. I think it was a Friday. I'm not positive of that, but I do know it was a weekday, not a weekend.
So what did he discuss with you that night? We'll say roughly August 10th, possibly Friday 19th. We can go back and hit all of us people that like historical events and archives that haven't been in books yet. These can't be in any of the Reagan books by Patsy Reagan, you know, so or anything, because people, even though they've been very close, especially their daughters, they don't know what went on behind closed doors. They don't know who you are unless, you met Patsy, yeah, you met her, didn't you? You met his daughter, but that was out at the ranch after he got out of office, wasn't it? Or did you meet him? Well, we may be going way down the road, right?
I met his son at the ranch in California.
All right, so you didn't meet Patsy. She doesn't know who you are.
No.
She's like the rest of us people out here, that we're all really sort of dumb when it comes to our reality, because a lot of things go on in this world, folks, that we have no clue. So that's why this ACO and ACIR is fun and important. And we can get a lot of the history that fell through the cracks, right? And that's what tonight's about. And Thomas R. Morris has joined me. And now I've changed it to Meeting President Reagan. 89.3 Untold History. But we're just getting started, so this is going to be a series, and it's going to be fun to share. And Tom's health is failing him. Even though he's born May 16th, 1959, in Lafayette, Tippecanoe County, Indiana, and we're living in Kentucky near Owensboro and close to Bowling Green, but in Beaver Dam, Ohio County, Kentucky. Now, Thomas R. Morris met President Reagan, and it was to receive a medal because he'd gone through all these great schools and got all this training, which basically had nothing to do with anything, because he happened to be in the right place in the right time, being sent to Germany. And he was in this house, which you can read in his books. One's called Lies, Spies, and Political Games. And one, I can't put my hand on it right now. It's usually right here in my bookcase. Let's see. Here it is. Spy Games. Is this the one about Wolfgang, honey?
Yeah.
Okay, Spy Games. But that's on Lulu.com, but it's by Thomas R. Morris, author of Spy and Military Murder Mysteries. And I've got to work on his books. He's written some for years and years, and we've lost the disc. But we're going to find it, we hope. It's sad. So now what I'm trying to do is go back and get it while he's alive, on voice recording. I'm going to download on my computer, somehow get saved. But you guys, if you want to save any of you historians out there, if you, you know, download this, please, and put it somewhere, and because it may be the only ever recorded history of these true stories that you will not know, and a lot of people don't know. Not even the CIA know this, do they, Tom? They don't know how it all transpired. And they didn't have, back then, the CIA didn't have the kind of stuff. And we were always in, dating NSA, CIA, whomever. Guys, I never knew. I mean, they'd tell me. They'd show me their cards. But I was always independent, and different guys would come through. Now, Tom has met the President of the United States of America based on being at the right place at the right time, meeting at terrorist, recognizing him, helping to catch him over the stealth bomber or the stealth plans. But he was on this thing for 10 years with the FBI or whomever, whatever this list is. But he was given it coming into states or into Germany and caught this guy red-handed. And it was a big deal in the world of spy games. So, you know, read his books, his stories. He changes the names, but he gives you the basic stories in fiction. But the line, you know, the timeline isn't really there, but the way that things happened are, and we're going to try to get some more of those stories down. But this is for the Historical Archives, and we are the Ace Folk Life, and my company is ACO LLC Kentucky. Tom is my husband. Now, Tom, we've still got 21 minutes or so for this archive left. You've met President Reagan, and we know that you become Agent Morris, and there's a whole history through 13 years. But you are in the White House, and sort of what does he tell you? Does he say, thanks for saving my life? I heard about this. How do you get out of the White House? Let's pretend we're writing a treatment for a movie.
I went and escorted me to his office or his home in the White House, and I went into the study, and the two or three men that was in there decided it was time for them to go home, and I left. And left just me and Reagan there. And Reagan thanked me again for foiling the would-be assassin's plans. And I just told him, well, sir, it was, I was just there, and I know what he was doing because I was trained to do it. And yeah.
Okay there, buddy?
Yeah.
You need me to come get you some water?
I got some. I swallowed a piece of hard candy.
Oh, don't do that. That's not healthy. One of your cinnamons for your...
Yeah.
All right, for history, you know how this goes. A year from now, you'll be wondering, what the hell were you thinking? All right, old timer. So we've got season 3, episode 8 is going to be this with Thomas R. Morris, who's met President Reagan, wound up being good friends with him, folks. Well, I don't know. When did he get out? Do you remember? Because Bush comes in.
88 was his last year. Bush took over 89.
Okay. So the last 4 years was for President Bush.
See, the election is an even year, you know, 1980, 1988, 2002, so on and so forth. But that's the election. It's in November. And then the president or the electee, the one that gets elected, takes office in January of the following year, which would be an odd year, like 89, 2003, whatever. It's been that way for years and years and years. And it's always the same numbers, so it's just, but yeah, I met Reagan in his office, and I guess that's where, in his study, and I guess that's where... we got to know one another a little bit better, and of course, I downplayed my role in capturing the guy that was planning on shooting him, which, actuality, I know in my heart that man meant to shoot Reagan. And from his position, he would have killed Reagan. And but he never got the chance to make the attempt. So therefore, you can't say that I saved Reagan's life, because the men may have chickened out before, and not done it. But in my mind, I don't think so. If I hadn't have stepped in when I did, Reagan would have been dead. Of course, that's just my opinion, and, the old saying, opinions are like buttholes, everybody's got one. That's it in a nutshell. He thanked me again for foiling the guy's plans, it was, we chit-chatted a little bit, and then I left, and I went back to the Watergate Hotel, and I spent 2 days in Washington going to the Washington Monument and, all the little tourist places in Washington, D.C., by the Secret Service drove me around, I had that lieutenant as a guide, and she had lived in Washington for some time, and so she was up on all the monuments and all that. We went to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, and we went to the she showed me the hill. Congress and the Senate and all that good stuff. We took tours of everything but the White House, and I didn't take a tour of the White House until, I guess probably a year or so later, and I took a regular tour like any other tour tourist would do, and listened to their spiels about the different rooms. You know, they have the Lincoln room, and they have the Eisenhower room, and I think they change them up every now and then, put different names on the same room, but that's just my opinion. I mean, after all, there's been a lot of presidents, and there's not that many bedrooms in the White House. And they didn't build a new bedroom for every president. The White House is a very large building, and it is a beautiful building. And there's chandeliers, and there's furniture that was given to a particular president during his term by foreign dignitaries in foreign countries, and it remains in the White House as a contribute to that president that received it, such as the Oval Office presidential desk was given to the President of the United States from the Queen of England. I think it was given to Roosevelt. Not really sure. But it was due to World War II, I think, is why he was given that desk by the Queen of England. And then there's a grandfather clock in one of the lobbies in the ground floor. It's probably 10 foot high, and it's a big old clock, and it was made in Germany. It was all handcrafted, all the gears, and it's made of wood. Real rocks is the weights. And it was given to a president from some bigwig in Germany before the war. This happened in 1800. And it's there, you know what I mean? So there's a lot of historical things in the White House, not counting the president. You know, so have you hung up on me or?
No, I'm listening because I wanted you to have a chance just to talk about what you wanted to talk about, because I want to get all the history. And, you know, I plan on doing this again, and you did really good tonight. We've only got like 11 minutes left, but you've done really good tonight considering it was spur of the moment. You didn't know you were going to do this, so I thank you for your time. It's valuable. Our time is all we have that's irreplaceable on this planet. And I know people like Janet Lesson was born on February 6th, and that's the day President Reagan was born. So they share the same birthday, and I know she's a big fan of yours and been wanting to get a lot of your history down. And remember, she wanted to send some of her friends, or, you know, she got in touch with a lady that I sent her to when I was going to do how I wound up with this show after doing radio shows. You remember when I wouldn't do shows, or we stayed out of the public eye for years and years and years. And then people were wanting to get me on the ET or alien ET UFO community. Some of my stuff I wrote for UFO Digest from 2007 till 2012. But, you know, we're going to want to get a whole different story. But the important thing is to build you up with the president's story and how you got so involved, because Reagan sent you on a UFO quest. And you went through Denver, and we just sort of mentioned that tonight. But you got to meet Gus, that looks like this stealth bomber. And I want to get that story down before you pass, so people, if they want it, it'll be here.
Denver had nothing to do with UFOs. It was secret documents that had been stolen.
Oh, that's right, the secret document. But later on in Denver is where you go and find the U.S. Treasury Department or something, somewhere where they kept secret documents, President Reagan sends you on a quest that people don't know about because he didn't know for sure about UFOs, if you know what I mean. This was before you were assigned underground.
Where it was Arizona.
Okay. Well, that's going to have to be a whole new two-hour story. So if you will, make you a note of that. Because that's going to be one of our archives. And, you know, but Reagan wanted to know about UFOs over in Area 51, just like President Eisenhower did. And I find it extremely amazing that these presidents come in and don't know jack. President Carter had seen a UFO. Now, I can't remember President Clinton did, but he served as the 42nd president from 93 to 2001. But I was all pumped because I was over in Hawaii when he came into office, and he came over, and he and Hillary stayed down the street, not a block or two from where I lived in Hawaii, which you can't possibly know. But I lived in Kahala, and a big mansion there, and I had the ocean right at my front door. Literally, folks, I was very blessed. Don't know how I made it all happen. I don't believe it was me. I believe it was spirit or guides or our ET connection or God source, whatever you want to call it, that special, I call it the ascension energy. But President Reagan and Hillary were down the way, and the men in black were all at my house. I was in my Cadillac, and I don't know what was going on, but I was trying to get to work, and they were trying to stop me. And I was like, I don't care if President Reagan's down the road. I'm going to work. You know, they had to escort my Cadillac down the road. I had to drive very slow. Of course, they knew who I was, and they had their little earpieces in. And this was in '93, I guess, because he was just turned president. But the men in black, and Tom and I are going to get in to share all this kind of stuff. We've had a very interesting life before we ever met. And now we're just good old country folk living in Beaver Dam, Kentucky, just old people and knowing all kind of stuff that happened, and you guys have no clues. So, you know, that's okay. And we haven't gone out and tried to get book agents in New York and, you know, get treatments for movies and get documentaries made or any of that. We haven't been about that. We haven't been about our public stories. But now, you know, as you get really older and you're not long for the time on the planet, you know there's things that may be beneficial to people. And, you know, even my kids have no clue how, because they weren't around. And they were mature teenagers and adults wanting to live their own life. And I brought my kids in 87 when I was in the U.S. Navy, and they could have had an option to live with me, and they chose not to. You know, they wanted to go back and live in Florida because their dad was down there, and we were divorced at the time. But they came up, and I had to go over to Washington, D.C., and redo a polygraph and a psyche eval and all the stuff you do for an intelligence world in Washington, D.C. back then. They actually had hard copy. Tom saw one of my hard copy files. Just to let you know, we used to carry them around in the intelligence world separately, just like the military. We literally carried our hard copy files with us, and our medical files with us. Remember that, Tom, when we used to carry our files with us? Everything was paper, hard copy, not in computers. So we're really old. Well, Tom, where do you want to leave this story so we can come back? We're in 1980 and 81, right?
Yeah.
So
I stayed in Washington a couple more days, like I said, and I didn't see Reagan after that that trip. I did some sightseeing and touristy things, and then I went back to Germany.
When did he make you an agent? Is that the next story?
Well, I was working for the agency, unbeknownst to me. I was kind of drafted into it.
Well, they didn't have you fill out a whole new paperwork. They just recruited you. They had your CID papers. We're all intelligence people. We're all the same intelligence world, you know. But back then, we were really separated by departments until 2001. We got this Homeland Security Gill and the terrorist thing and all this thing. We changed things up a lot in the computer world. But back then, you were still Army contract, like I was Navy contract, but the intelligence field can buy your contract. I don't know what it means, buy your contract, but they do. And that's unbeknownst. We don't see anything. I guess, did they have you sign some papers? Do you remember?
I don't remember, probably, but I worked for, I had a handler in Europe, and they would send me on different things and do a little bit of courier work, and I did a few investigations, and anyhow, it just kept progressing, and by the end of 81, I had went to Washington 3 different times. In 1981...
From August to December, right? Because August 10th is the date we're using that you met President Reagan 3 times, right? For the first 81.
But I went back to Washington 2 more times in that year.
What were they for?
Various things that I'm sure are still classified. And then I went to the Vatican as a soldier. The Pope, John Paul II, I think it was, or I'm not sure.
Are you saying the same? That's 1981. You meet the president, and then you save the Pope's life from falling down the stairs. He thought you were put there by God. That was 1981.
Yeah.
All that same year, folks. You got to listen. Well, this is amazing.
Plus, in 81 is when Wolfgang was arrested. So 81 was a big year for me, you might say. I met the Queen of England in December of 81 for the first time. It was a Christmas party that she put on every year. Actually, 9/10 out of 10, she would never attend it. She was up in years, and she most times she would make an appearance, and then, you know.
But John Paul, you're talking about
party.
John Paul II, right? Was because he
was
in August 2005. Pope John Paul II, because there was two of them. It was John Paul first.
So. I don't know which. All I know is a pope or old man. You know, I think he was in his 80s or something like that. And,
Bishop of Rome, etc.
He had come to Wiesbaden, actually to a town called Mainz, which is right across the river from Wiesbaden, and. He had done a speech and everything in the church, and the place was just packed. And you couldn't get in the church to listen to him. Besides, he talked in a language I couldn't speak. Of course, I couldn't speak anything then other than English, and I didn't do a very good job of that. So I was standing outside by the stairs that he was coming down. Just so happened I was standing there, and the streets over there were made of cobblestone. And he started down the steps, and he got tangled up in the robe, the white robe that he wore, and he fell face first. It wasn't but 3 or 4 steps, but he was on the top or second step, and he was falling forward, and there was no way he was going to be able to recover. catch himself. So I reached over the banister and grabbed him by the back of his robe and prevented him from falling and pulled him back up on his feet. He looked around at me and nodded. And by that time, his security was all over me. I mean, it was like white on rice. I mean, I just acted like I was trying to harm the man instead of preventing him from being hurt. And that was that. Well, I went on about my business, and a little while later, I was summoned to Rome, to the Vatican. The Catholic Church sent a Learjet to Germany to pick me up and fly me over, and I was just a kid. I just turned 21 the May prior to that, and of course I was listening to the Catholic men that was in my unit, you know, oh, you touched the Pope, you know, I mean, that's a, you know, death penalty. They're taking you home, kid.
He was from Poland. My great grandfather, mother's dad. You met my mom. Remember, you may not remember her talking about Nanny, her grandma's husband that raised mother, but they were from Poland. Nanny was from Ireland, and Grandpa Richmond was from Poland. You remember Mama talking about being Polish-Jewish and listening to her grandpa sitting by the radio listening to Hitler's stories? You remember her ever mention that? Yeah. Well, Pope John Paul's second, they called him the second, his personal papers are going to be published against his final wishes, according to Krakow, Poland. But they found some papers that he had told to be burned, personal prayers, reflections, and notes. So they're putting out a 640-page book that will be in the bookstores February 5th, so I'll buy that for you if you'd like, about his papers. I'd like you to read something on President Reagan. But, Tom, yeah, you're not much of a reader. But you lived life, Tom, so blessed. You've nearly been killed I don't know how many times, and our time, sadly enough, has come to a close. I don't know how long they'll let us go over, but we're over our 2 hours, and I'd like you to come back hopefully weekly is what I'd like to do, but we'll have to wait and see how you feel. But this 1981 was a big year for you. You met President Reagan, saved his life, then you go save, according to the Pope, President, you know, Pope John Paul II said you saved his life. As hard as that is to believe, folks, I know my husband, and you could put him on a polygraph. He lived this. So this is pretty important information that people may not have known.
Also, you've got to remember, I just happened to be there. It wasn't like I was one of his bodyguards, or I set out to keep him from having a real nasty fall that I think at 89 years old, I don't think he would have survived the fall, because cobblestone is one of the hardest stones there is. And
well, I believe he died in 2005 at 93 years old. I think President Reagan died 2004 at 93 years old. Let me look him up.
It doesn't matter. Bottom line is he was a very old man, and I just happened to be there and could reach him in time to keep him from falling.
He died at age 84 in 2005. So, yeah, I was close. Yeah, he died. They both died. 93 and 2004 was Reagan, and 2004. In 2005 was Polish Pope John Paul II. John Paul. His name was Jan Powit II, native name to Poland. Jan or Jan, like my name, Jan, J-A-N. His name was J-A-N, too. It's fate, Tom. I mean, destiny, maybe, if you believe. You know you've met extraterrestrials, and you know they exist, higher beings. And, you know, who's to say that you weren't placed there? We don't know how this works. We haven't compared our notes so much together and with other people that are into all this as historians and people. So maybe we'll be able to come together and give our story and speak among those that are wanting to know information. I know Richard Dolan had said he'd like to come down and talk to us, but there's various people that do this, and they're into the UFO information and all the information and history that wasn't disclosed properly in the past, you know, but they're dealing strictly with the exopolitics and UFO disclosure and things like that. You and I want to get the actual history of every little thing down that transpired, because it could change history, and it did change history. And how people like you and me are putting
in a lot of ways, you know, there are a lot of people affect history and change history. It's behind the scenes, and the general public will never know of their contributions. That's the way I feel it. Any contribution that I've made towards mankind was behind the scenes, and I don't see where it would benefit anyone to know that, yeah, Tom Morris was the reason this happened. The whole point of being behind the scenes is you want people to benefit from your work, but you don't want them to know who you are, because you don't want a big dog and pony show every time you go to McDonald's, get a hamburger.
Well, we're on the Pope John Paul's mission. He wanted the Jews, Muslims, Christians, all of them to come together, and that's what our mission on Earth. Is
I have no idea what his mission was in life, but it was his, not mine. My mission was to defend the United States, and I did the best I could. And a lot of things that happened to me and happened were complete accidents.
Well, do you remember what month it was that you met President John Paul? Because he saw it as a performance of a miracle, that you performed a miracle and a healing and was sent by God to save him from falling down those steps, because he was
That was his opinion, and that's the way he felt about it, and he thanked me for doing it. And he presented me with a beautiful, beautiful pure silver cross, I can't remember. I think it's a Saint Christopher. It's supposed to protect you.
He was 71 about that, because he was born 18 May 1920, and he died April 2nd, 2005. So you can figure up. You said it was 1981. You met Reagan in August 81. Do you remember, was it like September, October, November of 81 when you saved his life?
It was in the summertime. I believe it was before I met Reagan that I did it. But it was after I seen Reagan that I was summoned to Rome, the Vatican.
So you think you met the Pope first, and President Reagan may have heard about it, and maybe he didn't, because you were summoned through the United States Army. So you're saying
right,
the summons.
I hadn't met him. You got to understand, I didn't meet the Pope that day. They snatched him up and without a word to me, and put him in his little glass car, and they took off. Somebody was trying to kill him, and they was getting him out of harm's way, when all it was is he tripped over his robes and almost fell, and I just happened to be there and snatched him up to keep him from hitting the ground. And I didn't think it was a heroic act then, and I don't think it was a heroic act now. It was just something you would do anyone. If you were standing right beside them and they almost fell and you helped them prevent the fall, that's just being polite, being a decent citizen, a decent person.
And you were there in your military uniform, so he knew to track you.
No, I was being close. It was a weekend. I was off. I was over there. Of course, they had been advertising that he was coming and all that. And I was not Catholic, but I was a young, curious person. And I had the opportunity to meet or see him. Not actually meet him, but see him. So I took the opportunity, and it was... just crossed the river, so I went over to see him. And, it was just like, I was standing there on the street, and somebody walked by, and they tripped, and they was falling. I reached out and kept them from falling. That's all it was to it. And I didn't feel, and I think that if it had been just another individual, not the Pope, another individual about to fall down a set of stairs, and I prevented it, it went on and no one would have ever thought anything about it, but the big thing was he was the Pope, and of course he had, powers that most men just dream of, and if they ever get them, they wish the devil they hadn't. And that's the way it is with that. It wasn't a heroic act. I didn't jump in front of a bullet to save his life, or I didn't fall on a grenade to keep him from being blowed up. I just reached out to keep him from falling. So I don't believe that it was a heroic act.
Well, he said it was. He said you were put there by God. He believed in God. Do you believe in God?
Well, of course, but I don't believe in divine intervention.
Really?
I think
you believe in a supreme source and a divine ever-presence,
well,
all-compassing.
Man, the knowledge, learn about the human body and provide doctors to combat disease and stuff. And I believe that, keeping a man from falling was not a heroic act. I also believe that God didn't put me there just so on the sole purpose to keep him from falling. That's just ludicrous.
Well, that's what the Pope believed, and a lot of people believe in him and what he believed in, and that was what he told you.
Yeah,
in Latin
and,
or Italian, whatever. Italian, I guess. He's Polish, but I don't know. I don't really know. I guess he spoke Italian because he lived in the Vatican and in Rome, right?
Well, I don't know. He had a translator there, and he would say something, translator translated to me, and then I'd answer, and he'd tell the Pope what I said. So I never, and like I said, it wasn't a real big celebration or anything. I mean, I seen him that day. It was, probably 2 o'clock in the afternoon before I finally went into a big room where he was at, and he talked to me and gave me my cross and the St. Christopher or whatever it is.
What happened to your cross or St. Christopher or both?
Well, my ex-wife sewed the cross. And
how sad.
The St. Christopher medal, I lost it in Desert Storm.
Oh, so sad.
Desert Storm.
I'm sorry, honey. You don't have any memorabilia.
I wore it from 1981 when he gave it to me. I wore it from the day he gave it to me. I wore it up until I lost it in the desert. It was at night in a firefight, and the chain got broken, and the thing got buried in the sand, and I didn't even know it was gone until the firefight and everything was over with, and there was no telling where at. It was, so, you know,
well, explain to people what a firefight is. They're not in the military, or, you know, our government and our military, our intelligence community, a lot of them are young, and they don't understand the terminology, or they may not understand. But for those of you that do, forgive me, but for those that don't, explain what a firefight is, honey.
Firefight is where two conflicting groups are shooting at each other. They call it a firefight because there's live bullets flying. So, you know, hot firefight. That's just the definition.
That's pretty good. Yeah, firefight, right here in Wikipedia, folks, it says firefight, a large exchange of bullets between two sides. So that's what he just said, okay? This can't be any plainer. So Wikipedia is not doing a very good job. It's a very short. They don't even know much about what a firefight is. So good for you. You did a good job, honey. You used to teach some, too. I know you were an excellent speaker and teacher. And so appreciate you guests joining us tonight. We're a little running over time. We were supposed to be live 8 to 10, but we do have a guest on, amazingly so, this late time. So thank you, just logged in. But Tom actually worked for President Reagan, and he saved the Pope's life over in at the Vatican. Where were you on this death?
Elvis, you wouldn't say I saved his life because I just saved him from fall. I'm not sure that. Yeah, you know, I mean, he was, and like I said, I didn't jump in front of a bullet or fall on a grenade or anything to prevent his death.
He thought you saved his life.
Like I would anybody that was close enough to me and they were falling, I would try to break their fall or prevent them from falling.
If it was something simple, baby, he wouldn't have invited you. He wouldn't have tracked you down through the United States Army, sought you out, brought you to meet you, asked you if there's anything in the world you wanted, and then gave you the Silver Cross and the St. Christopher Medal. And that's maybe something he does to everybody. I don't know that he meets. But I would imagine that the people that work with him at the Vatican know that he thought you were special. And number one, most Catholics probably would never have put their hand on his robe. We're not Catholic, folks, but we work for those above that are sentient beings, sentient intelligent beings, and they've been around for, I guess, thousands if not billions of years. But Tom and I want to get into that story and share, even though it's going to sound crazy to most of you people, that's the story we're leading up to. But we got many years to get to that point, and I want Tom to tell it in his own words. So, Tom, I guess we need to go tonight, but I'd like you to come back, and you've touched on several stories that are most interesting, and I've gotten to hear some details through the years. I've been with Tom officially. We met somewhere on missions before we came, and you'd have to watch. Tom, there's a new movie out called television show called Intelligence. And you and I know that when we met, we had conflicts, like in Total Recall with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and later, I told you about. But we've had a very interesting life of just learning. And I asked Tom tonight, Mother trusted me, and I had to admit that my mother trusted me and was close to me. And Tom admitted that he depended on me, Mother depended on me, and he trusts me. And it was very nice to hear ask him, and it's true. And as you get older and older and you live with each other and you depend on each other and you trust each other, things are just nice to be able to talk to somebody. And now Tom and I are trying to get some history down in our archives. And he'll, of course, leave the part that he feels in his mind are classified. He would never divulge anything classified, which I had to make a report to the intelligence community about because something in me felt obligated. But Tom knows a lot about things that we didn't see or know about that even I don't know about. And from time to time, I get to hear stories that I didn't know because I wasn't there. But, you know, he doesn't discuss classified. He strictly discusses his life, that he lived when he was at right places at the right time. And if it crosses over, he doesn't discuss the details because he would never divulge classified information. And that was one of the missions. They wanted to make sure he was not discussing classified. But he does have some wonderful stories to tell that did happen that weren't classified, and they're very interesting stories. And I can't wait to get them out so you can read them in his books. Although we're way behind because he had a bunch of them on tape or somewhere on tapes. We don't know where those cassette tapes are when he was driving trucks. Tom, do you even know what you did with those cassette tapes? You used to make some of your stories on tapes. Are they in the barn?
I don't.
Huh?
No, I don't know where they are.
We don't know where they are at. And I know that they came, the government came and got some of your books or your black binder with some of your microfiche, things like that in, and some of them are in time capsules. And then other things are, it's just, we had some typing done, and we've lost those files. I've got a couple, two or three old ones that AOL sent me. They were old archives. But it's a sad, I've lost so much information. So we're going. This is the easiest for us to do, is just to archive it here on our T.J. Mars ET radio show and let the chips fall where they may. But it would be an interesting television show or movie made for television. And Janet Carolesson is very interested in getting it as a documentary or with Jose Escamilla in a documentary. And I've had several people interested in our story. So we're getting down the baseline here on the radio show just so it's the meat or the foundation or the history, and just for him and I. Not making any money, folks. We're poor as church mouse, as we say. Can't put two pennies together. We do okay. We you know, we've got large bills now, with especially with the heat and stuff, so we're just barely getting by trying to make ends meet, which I know all you guys out there. So, you know, our hearts with you out there, people, are just trying to make it. We could have been better off if we would have been evil, greedy type people, but we weren't. We were the typical raised to be good people, believe God, country, family, freedom, Constitution. And we're just everyday people trying to just make it paycheck to paycheck. So, all right. Well, Tom, anything you want to say? Because we need to go.
No, other than good night, folks, and thanks for listening.
All right, sweetie. Thank you for joining us tonight, and I look forward to having the future stories that you can share with us, okay?
Good night.
Good night. We'll leave this at 1981, Untold Story History. We've got Thomas R. Morris tonight, meets President Reagan and Pope John Paul II, 1981, Untold History with myself, Teresa J. Morris. Our category I've changed to history. This was show season 3, episode 8, for 2 hours and 24 minutes roughly. And we went over time, and thank you for Blog Talk Radio for letting us go over and not cutting us off. It was an important archive, so thank you so much. Folks, that's going to be it for ACO, ACIR, with T.J. Mars ET Radio on Blog Talk Radio. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. Enjoy the archive. For all of you that can't find it, we put it over in history, but you've got to listen to it to know that, right? So I'll let certain people in our ACE Folk Life History Club, ACE Society, and Ascension Center organization know so they can download it. Otherwise, I guess it's going to be here on Blog Talk Radio. So thank you so much for joining us. I look forward to another night with Thomas R. Morris, author, entrepreneur, founder of Ace Folk Life with myself. And thank you so much for joining us, folks. And we are proud United States American citizens, just trying to record a little history for everyone out there that may be interested. Thank you so much, and we'll see you tomorrow night. Tomorrow is Sunday. We'll be back 8 o'clock, same time, same station, that's Central Blog Talk Radio, TJ Morris ET Radio, and we are signing out. So thank you, and good night, folks.